What is up, Vermont Edition podcast listener? This is Elodie Reed, digital producer for VPR. Just to let you know, this podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today is the first day of school for Vermont K through 12 students after the governor pushed back a universal start date to give schools and the state more time to prepare for all the challenges that go with opening up schools during a global pandemic and an ongoing state of emergency. As we do most weeks, today on Vermont Edition, we're going to offer you a chance to get your questions answered about state policy and health issues in Vermont. Given the start of the school year, we might start there. And we're also going to talk about vaccinations, childhood immunizations for sure, but as well as the flu vaccine and the development of a COVID-19 vaccine. If you have questions you would like us to tackle today, now is your chance to give us a call. If you listen to the press conferences that happen twice a week and think, wait, I have a question about state policy, this is a great way to get your questions answered by state officials, particularly the health department. But the health department has such input in how many state policies get developed that it's really a great way to be able to talk to state officials about what you're wondering about, and certainly to get questions answered about any health issues related to COVID-19 or tangential to COVID-19 that you may be thinking about. Our number, if you have a question you'd like to give us a call, is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. And our email address, if you'd prefer to email us, is vermontedition@vpr.org. Tracy Dolan joins us again now. She's Deputy Commissioner at the Vermont Department of Health. Tracy, thank you very much for being with us. Tracy, are you there? Well, while we
were... I am now. Can
oh,
you
good.
Hear me now?
I can hear
Sorry
you
about
now.
That.
No, I know. It's an awkward time that we're starting here in the live show. So I thought, you know, maybe you were grabbing lunch. My lunch is stuck in
no,
the
I
microwave.
I was hitting the mute button too many times. I went mute, unmute, and then I think I went back to mute. Sorry.
Star six, Tracy. Star six. We're also joined today by Christine Finley, the Health Department's Immunization Program Manager. Chris Finley, nice of you to join us. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
So as I mentioned, let's start with some school issues because it is the start of the school year and so many students, so many teachers, so many staff members at Vermont schools and certainly parents really anxious, many cautiously optimistic, many very worried, but certainly everybody hoping that the start of the school year goes well, not just for everybody who's involved in schooling, but for the possibility of the rest of the Vermont economy continuing to open up a little bit and for people to remain healthy. Tracy Dolan, any updates that Vermonters should be aware of as we start the school year? It sounds like school's starting in phase two. Education Secretary Dan French hoping that we will move to step three soon if we don't have an influx of cases.
You know, not so much as an update, but just a continued really positive trend in Vermont. We saw a lot of colleges start in the last couple of weeks, and even we expected more of a bump than we've gotten in terms of positive cases there. So it was really great to see that the colleges had solid plans in place, a lot of students getting tested, quarantining before they arrive, low cases, because we were concerned about the possible connection between out-of-state college students coming in and the possible impact on the broader population and even K through 12. But now, as we begin K through 12 and we're still in a fairly low prevalence state with low incidence, we are feeling, you know, cautiously optimistic. And so I appreciate everything Vermonters are doing.
Yeah, it is an interesting confluence of so many events at once. The return of colleges, but luckily that was a week or two ago. There's sort of been a trickle and then a lot of college students returning, but so many college students now through their zero and their 7-day and in some cases even more testing with, as you said, a very low level of positivity in the state. But also then the Labor Day holiday, which traditionally is a time where families go away. Many families didn't have childcare for this week between the end of summer and the start of school since school was pushed back a week. So there may be a possibility of a lot of movement within the state, and that could also impact the cases that we have. Right, Tracy?
It could. Again, you know, the movement within the state not being as much of a concern as movement from inside and outside of the state. I think a lot of families adjusted plans and didn't leave the state or certainly didn't go to high prevalence areas before school started, and that helps us as well.
Yes, and if people did go to high prevalence counties before school started, they should be quarantining now, so they wouldn't be allowed into school if they're following
absolutely
the rules.
Absolutely.
Christine Finley, I want to talk a little bit about immunizations, and as is your specialty, because in the spring, when so much was shut down and certainly routine pediatric care was, if not shut down, really curtailed, we talked about on this show and we saw in the state the childhood immunization rate dip for a little while. And I'm curious what you know right now about whether that has come back up or if it's sort of stabilized at a lower level, because a lot of people still not necessarily accessing routine care.
So we've been following monthly, and what we're looking at is not so much the rates, but the vaccines administered, because that's an earlier indicator. And what we've seen is that it didn't fall off that dramatically for the 0 to 36 months. It seems like those young babies got in and they've been catching up nicely. What we're seeing now is that where there still seems to be a gap in when we compare vaccines administered by month in 2020 with 2019 is we're seeing that 13 to 17, that the teens aren't getting in and we're not getting those up quite as much as we would like. But among the younger children, we're seeing a nice rebound.
Are you worried about the level for teenagers? Is that something that needs to be addressed, or is that likely to just come back when more normalcy returns, possibly someday?
Well, I think teenagers can be challenging if you think about trying to increase the HPV vaccine and how difficult that's been, because they also don't access the provider as much as they may normally do it. So I do think that's going to take some more work to try and get the kids caught up on their routine teen vaccines. And there's some plans that not only the health department's working on, but other partners are also very much involved with.
Christine, is there any sort of relaxation of the rules around kids entering the school system potentially without all of their vaccinations up to date? Because, you know, usually you have to submit them just to be able to go to school. But sometimes the dates that when you have to submit them don't necessarily line up with when you may have gotten care this year.
No, we haven't changed the requirements. And I would say we're among the vast majority of all states. So the children have a 6-month provisional admittance. So if you know, and again, the practices have been open and seeing children, you know, most did never close and many are open now. And so they're pretty much has been adequate time for catch up. But they also, if the school nurse identifies that for whatever reasons they're working on catch up, they do have 6 months to meet that provisional admittance. And we considered that. And when you look at that, though, I think that's really the worst thing that you can do is have a pandemic and then end up with more vaccine preventable disease outbreaks because you stopped vaccinating against MMR for measles or other things. So we felt it was really important now not to help contribute to a vaccine preventable disease outbreak.
Before we get to the flu vaccine, let's go to a call from Chris in Brownsville. Hi, Chris. Go right ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. And I didn't feel like I needed to talk to you on the air, but this is a privilege. My question was just about the testing strategy. Vermont makes tests available to groups of people who request it or under specific circumstances. But I was wondering if Vermont had ever considered some kind of surveillance testing or random selecting groups of population just to get the background frequency or to spot rises in certain groups or certain age groups or certain population groups.
Chris, thanks.
And I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah, Chris, thank you very much for the call. Tracy Dolan, can you tackle that?
Sure. You know, we actually considered all kinds of things early on, including what your caller mentioned as well. And so when we first started testing, first, of course, we were testing those who most urgently needed it. And we opened it up somewhat to a more broad-based asymptomatic population. But what we found were just very, very low levels of the virus. And so while that might be a strategy in some states that have higher prevalence, it doesn't make sense for us. It makes better sense for us to use our resources here with either those who are symptomatic, those who have been in touch with a case, or those who have traveled. And so that's where we're focusing. But understanding that that might be an approach you know, other states might want to take. We do have a lot of people tested in Vermont. You know, up to a quarter of our population has been tested. So we have done some very broad testing when you actually add up all the numbers.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about the way that testing was conducted in sort of the middle part of the last 6 months when it was really opened up and anybody could go and get a test, at least theoretically, if they needed or wanted one, that was in some ways testing a wide swath of the population, many people of whom were not symptomatic when they got tested.
Yes, and we actually, you know, what we learned, and the good news was when we tested broadly for asymptomatics, we actually found very, very low levels of the virus, and that has held true. So that strategy that your caller mentioned, while it might make sense for some states, doesn't make sense for Vermont.
You know, I understand that other issues might be the ability for people to say no to testing, that they would say, I don't, you know, you can't mandate that I get tested if I don't have any symptoms, and that you could run into that kind of privacy and personal personal sort of freedom kind of issues. But I know that in Burlington, for example, there's been a pilot test right on the sewage, which is a way to sort of test for COVID-19 before an outbreak has started to appear in the general population. Is that something that the state is considering at a wider approach, or maybe at the school level?
You know, actually, Dartmouth Hitchcock approached us about this a few months ago up at one of our rest stops. They were looking at doing a research project. So it is still somewhat a research oriented approach. And we're not recommending that widespread for Vermont, but we recognize that it might be something that Burlington can learn from.
Well, Burlington is doing it, right? I think they were doing a month-long pilot program with through the sewage treatment plants that started on August 10th.
That's right. And so that's what I mean when I say it's something we can learn from. So they can look at that and see what they learn from that. What it would tell us is, you know, hard to know right now. It may tell us, it might give us an early warning sign of an outbreak. But at this time, that's not the direction that we're headed in. But recognizing that we may learn a little bit from Burlington's approach.
Again, our number, if you have a question for our health update, 1-800-639-2211. Marna is calling in from Montpelier. Hi, Marna.
Hi. I'm interested in hearing from these experts on immunizations about the regular flu vaccine. What I'm hearing now is we're being encouraged to get them early, like soon. And in the past, I've always tried to put it off later to have a longer immune response through the flu season. So I'd like to know what their recommendations are.
Thanks for that question, Marna. Chris Finley, what is the recommendation?
Oh, that's an excellent question. And timing is always something that we get questions about. So the CDC recommends that you get flu vaccination between September and October. But realize that we know that those 65 years and older may have waning immunity. And so if they have waning immunity, you wouldn't want to get it too early. So you aim for somewhere around October, but okay to get it between, if it's a little bit after, that's absolutely fine.
What about for those who are younger? Are you recommending that people, it's fine to get it now if you're not in that 65 and older age group?
Yeah, we are, because many of the children, the first year they get the flu vaccine, they need two doses 4 weeks apart. So it's really important for them to be able to get that in. And particularly, we want to do all we can to prevent flu so that we don't have both diseases circulating at the same time. So for school-age kids, now is a great time to be getting it. And we've already placed, the state provides a lot of the vaccine, and particularly the majority of all vaccine for children. And we've already placed the first order, and we know that most practices already have it.
Oh, good. I was going to ask about that. I was actually speaking with a friend who's a nurse about that, saying, one of my children has to go in for a routine visit. I'm hoping they can get the flu vaccine. And she was saying, I don't think the flu vaccine is available yet,
which I thought it was.
So yeah, can you clarify, if people are going in, whether they're children or adults, should they be able to access and get a flu vaccine right now?
Yes, they should. And one of the things that to recognize is allocation doesn't come all at once. So we don't get all the flu vaccine that we've ordered for a season, but we've already ordered for practices, and we'll be placing another order in 2 weeks. And so we ordered far more than we've ordered in past years, because there's much more interest in the flu vaccine this year with the co-circulation of the COVID. So now is definitely the time to ask and to get vaccinated. And we know providers are also very interested in doing clinics off-site, whether at schools if possible or at community locations. And so there may be new places that people can more easily access flu vaccine than in prior years.
Let's just talk about the cost. This came up last week when we were talking, Tracy, with you about the flu vaccine. And Chris Finley, you sent us along some information to clarify that the flu vaccine should be free of cost for most Vermonters. And I don't know if you have your bullet points in front of you. I have your bullet points in front of me if you don't.
I don't.
what you both sent us was that Medicare Part B covers flu vaccines for those 65 years and older. And then in the state for adults who aren't covered by Medicare Part B, the flu vaccine is provided, it's given to providers at no cost for those who are 19 years and older. And there isn't really an age limitation. But not all practices choose to order their vaccine from the state. And so if they're purchasing their vaccine privately, they can charge. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
So anybody who's getting a flu vaccine at their provider through the state won't be charged. Those whose providers access their flu vaccine privately may be getting a charge. Do you have a sense of what that charge might be?
I think it varies from place to place. And, the vaccine is typically purchased for less than $30, but what they may charge may be higher. And then just to clarify, there may be an administration fee. Insurance typically covers it, but that's also the piece that goes with it. And I just also want to mention that if you're uninsured, you can get a vaccine at no cost at our 12 health department district offices.
Okay, so there is a way to get it whether you have insurance or not.
Mm-hmm.
And UVM Medical Center chose not to enroll in the state program. So if you're accessing your flu vaccine through the largest provider in the state, the largest network, they're not getting their flu vaccine from the health department?
That's correct.
Okay. Other questions about the flu? One question is, are we going to have a flu season that is as robust as it normally is? Early signs from the Southern Hemisphere suggest that perhaps because people have been staying apart from each other and now because we continue to wear masks and take other preventive measures to prevent the spread of this one virus, COVID-19, we may be actually slowing the spread of other illnesses, including influenza, and that we may not have as bad a flu season in this country as we would normally expect. Chris Finley, and I'll go to Tracy Dolan on this as well, but Chris Finley, what are you looking ahead to and expecting?
I have paid a lot of attention to this question, and I've been following the Southern Hemisphere pretty closely, particularly looking at Australia, where we knew they had a high uptake, but their rate of flu is dramatically lower. But the one piece that, when I review what experts have said about it, the one piece that's a concern is that in many of those countries, people are much more likely to adhere to the social distancing and the wearing of masks than we have possibly been in the United States. So that's if we can have a high flu vaccination rate and continue with masking and distancing, that would really hopefully reduce the presence of flu this year. But it's kind of that wild card of how Americans are going to act and what we'll see.
Mm. Tracy Dolan, anything to add?
Chris is our expert on this, so I will defer to her opinion. Thank you.
And let's go to Katie Ann, who's calling in from Colchester. Hi, Katie Ann.
Hey, good afternoon.
Hi.
I'm actually at my son's pickup from his pre-K program, and I also have a seven-month-old. So I was just curious in terms of, I realize this is like our initial experience with this virus, this part of this virus, and I'm just looking forward. Is there going to be like a COVID season, like quote unquote, like we have a flu season in the future, or is this something that, you know, we'll be able to eradicate? Just curious if it's just like kind of one of those, something we're just going to have to add to the list of, you know, things to be concerned about as parents, looking forward, not in like in a fear-based way, but just, you know, kind of just looking at it realistically.
Yeah. What are we going to have to live with, and what's the scenario moving forward? But you're asking the $64 million question that I think everybody wants to know. And Tracy Dolan, I mean, certainly work continues on a COVID-19 vaccine, but how effective that's going to be, whether it's something that could eradicate the disease, remains to be seen. But what about this question, first of all, of whether there could be sort of a COVID season, like we have a flu season? Is that something that you've been reading about?
There was talk early on from CDC that a COVID season in the future might coincide with a flu season, in that it may pick up in the fall and peak during the winter. And so that is one thought. The virus may continue to circulate on an annual basis, so this could be possibly an annual vaccine. I think we don't know what it's going to look like, but there is a possibility that this will continue to circulate, and this may become simply part of the list of vaccines that we take on an annual basis. And maybe I'll defer to Chris, who probably also does some reading on this as well.
Chris Finley?
I'm hoping we don't end up with another annual one, but I think right now it's just too soon to tell.
You know, one of the questions that had come up initially was whether this was a virus that would die back in the warmer months. And it doesn't look like that's the case, but we could see a higher concentration in the colder months, at least in this region, because people are pushed together more. Is that right? I mean, we could see sort of a different transmission rate just based on the way we live, not necessarily based on the life cycle of the virus.
Yes, I think, you know, the interesting part is I remember when this first came out, everybody wondered what would happen when the summer months came, and then think about Florida. Mm-hmm. and the southern states of what we've seen. So I think we still need to see what happens when we go through when we head back into winter and people go back indoors to see what really we're going to find out.
While we're talking about flu and vaccines, let's go to Dorothy, who's on the line with us from Johnson. Hi, Dorothy. You have a flu question?
Yes, I do. Actually, two. First of all, last winter, there was something available that I referred to as like an extra strength vaccine for elders. I'm wondering if that's going to be available again this year.
Chris,
that's my first question.
Yeah, let's get an answer to that, and then I'll come back to you, Dorothy. Chris Finley, is there sort of this double strength vaccine for older Vermonters?
Yes, there is. There's actually two vaccines that are made for people that are 65 years and older. One's called high-dose flu vaccine, and one is called Flu-Ad, and that has an adjuvant. The high-dose flu, both there's research going on with both of those to compare them with each other. But when compared to routine vaccine, an earlier study showed that the high-dose vaccine was about 24% more effective. It has four times the antigen, so it's a stronger vaccine. When you get it, your arm may be a little sore, but it's recommended for everybody 65 and older. The caveat I'll say is that this year we expanded our program providing a flu vaccine at no cost, but we're unable to purchase that from the CDC. But most practices have ordered that ahead, and most pharmacies have that available.
Okay. Dorothy, you had a second question as well.
I do. I had been told in the past that the flu vaccine is most effective for about 3 months. And because of that, and knowing that the flu season in Vermont tends to run late January into March, I've always pushed for us to get our flu vaccines later than September, October. And I'm wondering if Chris has any comments on that. Last year we got it actually the end of November. And the flu was peaked here at the end of January.
So I can add a little bit to what I said earlier. Typically, flu season starts around December and may peak around January or February. And many of us are used to that. And when they looked back at 36 flu seasons, they found that 75% of the time that they did start in January and go through February and maybe into March. So the waning part, though, I haven't heard of the 3 months. I've heard of 6 months, and there's some variability in that. But if you're looking at being vaccinated in October, that's just a perfect time.
You know, while we're talking about this, I think Mary Ann, who's calling in from Rutland, may also have a question about the timing of a flu vaccine. Mary Ann, go right ahead.
I had a visit with my primary care physician on August 28th, and she told me to get the flu shot then. So I had a flu shot on August 28th. I'm 75 years old, and what I'm hearing is that I should have waited until October. What do I do?
Chris Finley, I sense a rising anxiety now from people who think, uh-oh, what have I got it already? So just help us understand, you know, in a calm way, what, you know, what especially older Vermonters should be thinking.
You don't need to do anything different. The recommendation is to be vaccinated in September or October. So you were vaccinated a few days early, but that's nothing that I would worry about. Also, when we talk about waning, what we mean is it begins. It's not like it's day and night where all of a sudden you're not protected. There may be a slight mild change in it where they're seeing it. So my advice would be you don't need to do any more than the routine pieces of washing your hands and wearing masks and what you're already doing. But I wouldn't at all worry if you ended up, and many people may have gotten it in August because I know it was out in pharmacies.
Good. Okay. So, Marianne, you should be fine. And 8:28 sounds like an okay time to have gotten the flu vaccine. Thank you for clarifying that, Chris. While we're talking about all kinds of health issues, many Vermonters wondering still about masks. Some Vermonters having questions about testing. Tracy Dolan, we got a question from another Tracy in St. Johnsbury who says, my sister, who is health compromised, was symptomatic, coughing, and had a heavy chest. She was tested with the nasal swab. She was notified that she had a negative test, but that she should quarantine because there's a 30% false negative rate on the testing. Why aren't we retesting symptomatic people who are showing serious signs of COVID-19?
Oh, that's a great question. I can't speak to the advice she was given about quarantining because of the possibility of the false negative. It's, you know, these decisions sometimes are made between a patient and their healthcare provider, and we certainly give a lot of discretion to healthcare providers to make their best decisions. But generally, we would encourage people to get tested in that case, and if they came back negative, we would probably normally not recommend quarantine. However, if your physician and you make that decision together, if your physician knows a little bit more about your situation, they may make that decision. We're not recommending repeat testing for the most part, but there may be cases where a physician may request that.
Sherry writes in to say, I'm not convinced that more education will do the trick to get people to wear masks unless they've been hibernating for the past 4 months. They already know about it. After all, people still smoke even after all these years of knowing the dangers. Beyond education, what can be done? Tracy?
Sure. Well, education can be pretty effective. I mean, even though people hear messages, sometimes it's the readiness to hear the message. So I might hear a message today and respond. You, Jane, might hear it next week and might be in a different place in your life, or maybe somebody close to you just became ill, and it might have more meaning to you in that moment. And so education can make a difference. And just the socialization. So going into a place and seeing people wear masks, that kind of positive peer pressure alone can make a difference. And then policy can make a difference. So the governor mandating masks, we heard from callers last week who run businesses who said that they definitely saw an uptick in the number of people who walked into their store with masks. Where education doesn't work so well is when you have people deeply entrenched in a belief. So if someone truly believes that a mask isn't useful, they might be less likely to respond to education or even a mandate. But education, policy, and that positive peer pressure of just seeing it around you and feeling like you'll be the odd man out if you don't, all of those can help.
It's interesting that Sherry adds that example of smoking, because isn't it true that the smoking rate, I mean, Vermont's rate, I think, is significantly higher than the national rate, but Vermont did see a significant decrease in smoking, particularly among young people, when there was a really big educational push about the dangers of smoking?
There are actually a few things that push that rate down. Education is one, but policy change. And, for example, making cigarettes a lot more expensive has a big impact on smoking, and also making it difficult to smoke in a lot of areas, because making it illegal to smoke in public places also drives it down. So it's education, but it's rarely one thing that changes behavior. It's usually a multi-pronged approach, just like with mask wearing.
Let's go to Beth, who's calling in from Brattleboro. Hi, Beth. You're on the air.
Hey, Jane. How are you all?
We're doing well. How about you? What's your question?
I'm fine, thanks. So I have a quick question from a standpoint of a grandparent and a nurse, a grandparent of kids in first grader in local school. My understanding is that generally, at least in the school where she attends, if someone has strep, they let everybody know there's strep in the school. It seems to be a little harder for the schools to figure out how they're going to inform families about an infection, a COVID infection in the school. And I just would like some help understanding why.
Beth, thanks for that question. Tracy, let me start with you on that.
Sure. So we have been working with the Agency of Education on how we would approach a COVID infection in the school. And you can actually go on our website and learn a little bit more about what happens if there's an infection in the school. But we really do try to protect the identity of someone with a health condition, of anyone with a health condition. And so schools may not be very specific about infection, but it's likely a school would let folks know, but they may not be very specific. So you might not know what's in your classroom, for example. And that's been consistent with all the populations we've dealt with. So we engage in contact tracing, we work with a case, but we really try to limit the number of people who know, and we try, where possible, to provide the public information that doesn't identify someone.
You know,
Vermont's a small place.
It's interesting, though, Tracy, because it does seem maybe not I don't mean this judgmentally, but sort of inconsistently applied in the school setting based on what the illness is. You know, if somebody has head lice in a classroom, everybody's going to get notified. Somebody has head lice. You need to check your child for nits, or you need to, tell them not to share a hat. Beth says strep, you might get notified, but you don't necessarily get notified if there's a case of flu, nor would the school necessarily know that there's a case of flu. Presumably schools may be notified if there's a COVID case, but I suppose a parent doesn't necessarily have to tell the school that their child has tested positive for COVID-19 either, as long as they keep the child out. Or is there some protocol that says schools must be notified of all cases, and then the school decides, how to notify other parents?
I would have to check back to see if a parent is required to notify the school. I'm not aware of that. I think I would have to check back on that. But you're right. It is inconsistent. I mean, that's just how it is, right?
Sure.
Lice, for example, isn't a public health issue, but you're right. Sometimes schools will notify. Sometimes they won't, or they might say it for the whole grade.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're small, what we try to do is dilute the information in a big enough group that you can identify the person, but that people, parents, the public also feel informed. It shouldn't change your behavior very much. The idea is to continue to wear masks, social distance, wash your hands, stay home when you're sick. None of that would change if a child becomes infected in your school. And so that's what we're trying to do. But we also want to be as transparent as we can and still protect the public health information.
Beth, I'm curious from your perspective as a nurse and as a grandparent, and as presumably somebody who understands HIPAA and understands the need for privacy and the potential for somebody to be shunned or to have negative consequences if their identity was easily discovered. What do you think would be the right approach? I mean, what are you calling for if you think that this isn't the right approach that the state is taking?
Well, first of all, I think that in a pandemic when people's lives are at stake, I think that it makes sense to suspend HIPAA. I totally understand that we can't. I also believe this is not a lot of privacy anyway. However, I absolutely don't think people need to be identified, but it concerns me that we're stigmatizing people who have the disease when we start doing that. I've been working in mental health forever and find that, to some degree, privacy is stigma. And I mean, it fosters stigma. So, to some degree. So I just think that people should, that should be a general statement.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to include a classroom, a grade, and anything. I just think that families should be informed. And I think that parents should be required to let the school know if somebody is tested positive. So that would be my recommendation. And I really would avoid stigma at all costs. And I think that's about education.
Yeah, Beth, I really appreciate your perspective. Thank you for sharing it. And thank you for following up a little bit, because that is an interesting question on, what is the best approach to making sure that we don't stigmatize people for various illnesses or conditions that they have? And how do we do that? And the way we talk about things and the way we approach notification is an interesting idea around how we then think about an illness. So thank you for bringing that to our attention. And maybe we can follow up with the Agency of Education in the next week or two around whether or not parents are expected to notify the school and how that might work. Because I know there are a lot of questions, more so than just what you have, Beth, about how schools are going to talk to people about COVID-19 infections. We have a question from Brian in Arlington who wonders, have we learned anything from Red Cross antibody testing of blood donations? Tracy Dolan?
I am not aware if we've learned anything from the Red Cross antibody testing.
Which is not a Vermont program, but is being done in Vermont through the Red Cross for people who are donating blood.
Yeah, and I have not been aware of any shared information on that, although we do have a scientific advisory committee that may have looked at that, and I don't know if Chris knows any more about that, but I'm not aware that we've gleaned any lessons from that yet.
Chris, have you heard anything?
I've heard that, I won't mention Vermont. I've heard that showing low seroprevalence in certain areas, but we would have to go back and get some details from Vermont.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see those antibody tests broken out by region, you know, and what it suggests or is starting to tell us about the picture of who may have been exposed to the virus based on geography. You know, the percentage in New York City is expected to be significantly higher than the percentage of people in all of the state of Vermont who have been exposed to the virus. So that will be interesting to look at. And we'll see, Brian, if we can get more information for you and tweet it out about what so far has been studied nationally or in other regions. Elo,
I do have a follow-up on the question that was asked earlier. I checked in with our school health folks.
Oh, good.
So if there's a positive student in the school and they were contagious while they're in the school, so if we looked at the case and determined that that was a contagious period, then the school will tell the parents and staff. They will do it in such a way so as not to reveal, you know, too much information about the student, but they will tell parents and staff.
And is that true even in the schools that have a total population of students and faculty staff of 25 or fewer? Because that's a question that's come up in the press conferences that Ed Secretary Dan French said. The very, very small schools in Vermont, and it's something like only 15 of them, are really going to struggle with that privacy issue. And so there was a suggestion that they will not be revealing information about cases, at least on a larger statewide basis.
Yeah, I would say this is probably for the larger schools. For the smaller schools, I think it will be a challenge to maintain HIPAA and to reveal that information because of small numbers.
You know, I think this is
The other answer that came back, I think somebody asked, you know, do parents have to notify? They don't have to, but we strongly encourage it. And based on what we know about parents in Vermont and their general behaviors around this or around other contagious diseases, we've got really good reporting and communication. So it's our expectation that based on what we know, they will be likely to report, but they're not required, but we strongly encourage it.
But it's going to be interesting, Tracy, too, because, you know, we heard state epidemiologist Patsy Kelso say in one of the press conferences a week or two ago that just because there has been a COVID-19 case in your school, and even if it's been in your child's classroom, doesn't necessarily mean that your child has a high exposure risk. And
that's
so,
right.
You know, a lot of parents are saying, are you kidding me? You know, I'm going to want to know. But it's going to really, I think, vary and remains to be seen how schools and how individual classrooms are going to deal with any positive cases that come through the building and come through that classroom, because some of it's going to be public health, and hopefully most of it is based on public health and data. But it's also going to depend on, you know, what the school deems is the best and what parents are saying they need, I would imagine, in terms of what the reaction is.
Yeah, and schools will be told, if the child was infectious while they were at school, the schools will be told anyway. They may not be told by the parents, but the schools will find out. And I think what's really important for people to remember is most people are not close contacts of a case, right? Even if you've been associated with someone, if you're not living with them, if you haven't spent significant time with them, you know, within 6 feet for at least 15 minutes, you're likely not a close contact. And so the whole school certainly isn't a close contact. It might even be that there might be many students in the classroom that, based on our interviews, will not be deemed close contacts. So I think it's that initial feeling. Although I feel like the more we talk about this and the more information there is out there, the more parents are getting used to the idea that there's a pretty solid plan in place. And I think we've really tried to educate parents to expect that there will be cases and they will learn about cases, but also to understand that we actually have a really good relationship with schools and a good public health mechanism in place to contain it.
Let's get another call in here from Elo in Middlebury. Hi, Elo. What's your question?
Hi. I had a COVID test done on Thursday at the pop-up site in Middlebury. And they told me 2 to 3 days, and I asked for notification by email. And today is Tuesday, 5 days, and I haven't heard anything. Where can I find out my results?
Tracy?
Sure, and I'm sorry for the delay. You know, we do have a shortage of lab capacity nationwide. So we are able to send tests to labs, but because labs have been inundated, more probably by other states than us, it does slow down some of the response times. So if it's a positive, we prioritize that to get it back very quickly. Some of the longer turnaround times are usually for negative results. Doesn't mean for sure it's a negative result, but it's more likely to be negative if we're seeing longer wait times come back. And so apologies, you should be hearing soon, but there isn't any place that you could go look. You will have to wait for your result.
Could you talk a little bit about what Health Commissioner Dr. Mark Levine announced today with sort of a streamlining of test results and this ability to get your results via email that the state is working on, and said we should be able to get it up and running very soon?
Yes, we'll have an electronic reporting system, and we are all very excited at the health department about this so that people can go in and look on their own. Had a few glitches, but we're working that out. We've been able to stand it up, and we're hopeful that that will give people a little more self-determination about finding their own results and booking, obviously, themselves for appointments, but also finding their own results, much like a portal that you would use with your primary care provider.
People who don't have email or don't use email are still going to be able to, they're not going to be disenfranchised just because they don't have the ability to do this digitally?
No, of course we will figure out ways. We will still use our other systems to get results to people who are not able to access results digitally or through our electronic systems.
Let's go to Sue in South Londonderry. Hi, Sue. Go right ahead. What's your comment or question?
Hi. My question is kind of a weird one. I rely on the state for, you know, what's important for me to know and to do. And I'm questioning whether or not if a vaccine shows up on the scene and they're telling us to prepare to receive it, first responders and stuff right away, if the state is, if there's not transparency at the federal level of that all the hoops have been jumped through for this vaccine, can the state of Vermont say, no, we're not going to administer this to our residents?
Sue, your line was in and out, so let me just paraphrase what you were saying and your question so everybody could hear it. So Sue says, look, I really rely on information from the state, and I trust what I hear from the state. So if the federal government comes out with a vaccine and says it is safe, can the Vermont state government basically come out with its own policy and either refuse it if it doesn't think that the federal government has followed the proper guidelines and the proper procedure, or to sort of say, yes, we also support this. We are going to distribute it in the way that we deem is appropriate. Chris, can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think there is a lot of concern and fear and questions about the COVID-19 vaccine that's in development and whether it will go through complete phase three trials in the way that most medications would. And so how should people think about whether they can trust it or not, and your approach to that?
Oh, I think there's been so much in the news lately that has left people just reeling, trying to understand this. There's a few things that have happened recently that have helped me feel more comfortable. One is I heard the head of Operation Warp Speed, Dr. Slawi, speak, and he was very clear that he is going to let the science guide us, and the science is what they're based on. And he actually said he would quit if it changed. I think the second one is the letter that's expected from the manufacturers today saying that they will not bring their vaccines to the FDA for approval until they've been through everything. So they're very unusual. The manufacturers are making an ethical commitment to say, we will not do this until it's there. And then I think one of the other things that many people don't understand is there's not only the manufacturer's safety guidance, but there's also the government has got many things where they look for safety at the same time. But what I think is real important is we will also be looking at it and monitoring it, as will every state. But I think there's things that are happening now that may contribute to making the public more secure about feeling that the vaccines will be safe and not rushed.
Tracy Dolan, what would you say about that? I mean, as we heard last week, states have been asked by the CDC to prepare for the availability of a vaccine within the next couple of months. That doesn't mean that it's going to be available, but they've been told to prepare. We've heard from the president that people should be able to see a vaccine on the market before the election. Lots of people saying that's not possible. And, you know, Chris Finley is talking about ways that manufacturers and the head of the CDC are trying to reassure people. What's the approach of the state of Vermont?
Sure. The state of Vermont is responsible for the health and well-being of our population. And we will look at everything that we need to look at. We will certainly not promote a process or a product or any procedure that we don't have comfort with. So as much as the CDC may recommend it, we will certainly have our own people look at it as well and ensure that it went through the right steps. So rest assured that even if you have a lack of faith in what's happening at higher levels, we're going to make sure that we are very comfortable. I mean, in the same way that we've used discretion on some of CDC's guidelines this year during this pandemic, which has been a little unusual, we will utilize our discretion here to make sure we make the best and safest choice for Vermonters.
And Chris, just in a couple of seconds, are you thinking as well about it, sort of a distribution framework for who in Vermont might get the vaccine first once it's available?
Yes, there's work being done on by two different groups, the CDC and the National Academies of Science, to identify priority populations. And then we will, of course, look at that and look at our data. And lots of work is being done to plan and to assess the need that we have across the state.
Good. Well, we'll book you now. We'll have you back on once we're at that stage. Chris, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
That's Christine Finley, Immunization Program Manager for the Vermont Department of Health. Tracy, thank you for talking with us as always. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Tracy Dolan is Deputy Commissioner for the Vermont Department of Health.